Welcome to Context Matters. I am Cindy Parker. I am a writer, a speaker, and an educator who loves to gather around the table with interesting people to talk about God, the Bible, theology, and as you will find out later in this season, other tangentially related subjects. I would like to extend a very warm welcome to all of you for joining me in this brand new season of Context Matters. And of course, I have to give a massive thank you shout out to the Patreon team because their support is what makes this podcast sustainable. I want to start this season thinking about wisdom, which is why I am so pleased to have Dr. Elaine Phillips as our guest today. She is the Distinguished Professor of Biblical Studies Emerita at Gordon College in Massachusetts. I admire her so much, and while I am normally asking for her wisdom on much of academic life, I will contain myself and we will stay focused on the wisdom literature of the Hebrew Bible. Last week, we discussed what wisdom literature is and how we can approach the book of Proverbs. This week, we get to tackle Ecclesiastes, Job, and the book that makes people squirm, the Song of Songs. Dr. Phillips mentioned that her students often look forward to dealing with the angst and meaninglessness of life that seems to come across in Ecclesiastes. So let's listen in as she describes the way she engages this interesting book. Even as I went through seminary, I don't think I ever paid much attention to Ecclesiastes ever until I was applying for a teaching job and asked to prepare a lecture as part of my interview process on the book of Ecclesiastes. And I loved it. And then I fell into the book and I was like, wow, look, this book is all angsty and it presents all these questions that I have. And it has given some imagery and sayings into modern pop culture, even. So the phrase we throw around, vanity of vanities, is from Ecclesiastes.
And nobody knows what that means anymore because all they know is Vanity Fair. But anyway, yeah.
Right. But the eat, drink, and be merry is also from Ecclesiastes. And sometimes we toss on the extra bit that Isaiah has, which is for tomorrow we die.
And Paul picks up on that too.
Yes. How do we talk about this angsty book? And why is a book that seems to not come to many great conclusions, why is it in sacred scripture? What is it doing or offering to us?
I said at the beginning of our talk that I like to subvert some people's preconceived notions when they come into some of these books. And this is actually one place where I do. So if I may, the first thing I require my students to do when they are reading through out loud with each other is every time they come to the word meaningless or vanity, depending on what translation they're reading, I say, substitute breath. Or vapor. Just make sure that you read it with breath or vapor. And I require them to do that. And there's 31 or 32 of those occurrences in that book. So that's the starting point. Then the question I ask is, what's the difference for you between transience and meaninglessness? Because meaninglessness, or meaningless, or however you want to say it, is a value judgment. Transient is not. So that's our starting point. Moving on from there, and I have to give credit to Daniel Fredericks, who, 25 years ago, I can't remember exactly when he came out with his little thin volume called Coping with Transience. And maybe there were other people who were saying it at this point, but not too many. He said, we need to rethink how we translate that Hebrew word hevel, because that's the definitive word in this entire book. And if we're going to make it go through Greek and Septuagint and then into the New Testament, we're going to come up with a different meaning, maybe, than we should have if we simply read hevel as breath, vapor, here, and gone. And then I remind my students of our character in Genesis chapter 4, who's the brother of Cain, whose name is hevel in Hebrew. His life was here and gone. And then we go from there. And so basically, rather than this being, well, Bonhoeffer, I think, is the one who called it the Christ-shaped vacuum. And a lot of interpreters will say it's a dark foil against which we read the rest of Scripture, and we have to have that dark foil and so forth. I think it's a very feet-on-the-ground commentary on the transience of life. And by the way, there's all kinds of give and take back and forth amongst scholars in terms of how really to interpret Hevel. I mean, once you have breath or vapor, then how do you interpret it? That's another thing. But I like either elusiveness or transience, because then what's being said is that everything that actually does have a lot of meaning and does have a lot of substance, and we work hard for it. And the author of Ecclesiastes is going through those things multiple times. It's going to be gone, because the author is coming face to face with the fact that death is going to take all this away. It's no accident that Ecclesiastes is bookended by chapter 1, which is a poem, which echoes Genesis 3 stuff. The terms of Genesis 3 echo into chapter 1. And of course, chapter 12, well, that tragic poem is all about the dissolution of the human body and death. And then there's that postscript epilogue afterwards, which says, well, here's the end of the matter, fear God and keep his commandments. But that's not the only place God appears. Instead, just like life, which is full of all these things that are tough, you labor for this, you work for that, and so forth, and death takes it all. There are little bursts after every one of those anguished outbursts, and the little bursts that are happy say, here's the view from above the sun. These are gifts from God. And that keeps popping in there, chapter 2, chapter 5, chapter 7. And so it's kind of the same way it is when we are living our lives. Our feet are on the ground. It's tough. It's hard. But we keep getting visions that God indeed is still a sovereign master. He gives us these gifts. We're to enjoy them, but recognize that there's a terminus to them and death will bring it about. I love the book, not because it wallows in existential angst so much, but it recognizes that the author, possibly Solomon, or at least someone who's supposed to be looking like Solomon very clearly from chapter 2, close to the end of his life, and recognizes that, you know, fearing God and keeping his commandments is not a half bad way to focus on life. What's left of it. So just one more thing I want to say, though. The way I'm looking at this is actually corroborated by some of the other recurring phrases, because you have the author saying over and over again, I saw, I saw, I saw, I saw under the sun, I saw under the sun, chasing after wind. It's interesting that sun and wind show up right away in that poem in chapter 1. And here they are. That poem is setting the tone for the kinds of things that he's seeing. And yet he manages to maintain his perspective. It's kind of like breathing in and out, in and out, in and out. You know, when you take the breath in, you get the perspective from above the sun, if you will. These are gifts of God.
That's very nice.
So, you know, to my chagrin, after going through this in class, it is inevitable that a student will continue to use meaningless and vanity, but you know, at least we tried.
Right. My most favorite visual is one that you wrote in your book, making use of the New England temperatures, even like this time of year right now, when you exhale that breath that can be invisible, but in the wintertime, it is visible for a moment and expands and disappears. And I have carried that visual around with me ever since I read it. It is life. Like, you have to have that breath within you, and yet it does dissipate.
It does.
Yeah.
Well, and just one more thing in terms of structure, the book, as I'm sure you know, it's got conceptual parallelism built through it, and it goes back and forth and back and forth and back and forth, just the way we do when we breathe.
Interesting. That almost needs to be like an actual embodiment of breathing in and reading a couple stanzas and breathing out and reading a couple stanzas. That'd be an interesting way to just kind of embody what is happening within the text itself.
I like that.
Yeah.
Thank you. I like that.
Yeah. You said the students also think they want to start with Job. And you mentioned that if they know Job, they've probably read chapters 1 and 2, which are these interesting and confusing chapters because they are setting a stage of a story and it has to do with the heavenly realm. And so do you think we're supposed to be reading this as a real story, or does the fact that it opens up in this heavenly realm signal to us that it's more mythology, this story about Job that is going to unfold?
That, of course, is a huge question.
I know.
So let me just drop a couple of ancillary ideas out there, and then maybe I can circle back to that. There are enough other passages in Scripture where we have little glimpses into the heavenly realms that I don't think preclude our recognizing that, for example, Ezekiel, Isaiah, Micaiah, and 1 Kings 22 were, you know, I think we can say those were very real encounters and things in realms that we don't experience every day. So just because that's the way the book starts, I'm not ready to relegate it to some category of myth. And by the way, I'm a little uneasy with a hard and fast break between myth and reality.
Yeah.
I'm sure you are, you know, you wouldn't go that direction.
I mean, I asked this question, it seems to come from a lot of background or things that I've heard. And actually what stands out, even as I'm asking the question, is, boy, that's a Western mindset idea, as opposed to an Eastern mindset where this text was developed, which is just so different. This either or, how do I understand logically this thing, is very Western. Yeah. So I cringe a little, even though I'm asking the question.
No, it's thank you for saying that. I mean, it's a fabulous way to ask the question because it allows us maybe to pick apart at some of those distinctions that are a little bit too arbitrary, a little bit too hard and fast. I want to say one other thing as well, which I think attacks that myth label a little bit, or not. Ezekiel twice refers to Job, along with, interestingly enough, Noah and Daniel, who may be Daniel, maybe not, as righteous people. And as Ezekiel is referencing them, he doesn't say, oh, and these are people from our undefined past that we can't really, they're in some realm we can't relate to, because he's talking about their righteousness and the fact that even if they were there and righteous, it wouldn't do this people any good at this point in time. So Job is referenced by the sixth century as a very vital part of the tradition. So now let me go a little farther with that. I think it's helpful to, and you do this yourself, I'm sure, to make a distinction between the narrative framework, which is all about a person. The person is described with very symbolic kinds of numbers, but I don't think that precludes reality. They're just using symbols that have meaning in those contexts, and I'll come back to that in a moment. And that person lives outside a temporal and geographical context that we know as covenant-based Israel. The chapters, especially starting with chapter 4, that are the poetic dialogue, and then beyond that with Job's monologue and then Elihu and so forth, those have embedded in them such profoundly strong covenant concepts. They really do. And so then the question is, how did these come together? And I'm not beginning to figure that out. I'm just saying that we've got to deal with that as we think about the book and recognize that in Israel's tradition, historical, covenantal narrative as it went on, this was part of it. And the dialogues, however they originated, were certainly shaped with covenant concepts in mind. So, for example, when you have chapter 19, which of course is probably the other thing that people know from this book, I know my Redeemer lives, you know, that's Goel, that's the kinsman Redeemer. And somehow we have to understand what's being said there. And then there's stuff that shows up not just there, but other places, that echoes with things that we read in Isaiah. So putting all that together gives us an incredibly complicated, but beautifully complex backdrop for exploring something that's beyond the realm of myth, and beyond, I don't mean far out, but somewhere in between this. I think, you know, I'm not going to go to the mat for this. I think we have a historical Job. I really do. I think the way he's described, as I said earlier, is intended to convey something by use of symbolic numbers, 7, 3, 5, 5, 500, 500. Even his character description. And by the way, if I say nothing else about Job, the next 3 minutes are really important. His character description is fourfold, right? Three is superlative. He's got a fourfold description. So that says something. On top of that,
fourfold description, can you elaborate what that means?
Okay, so he is described as fearing God, shunning evil, being upright and blameless. There's four things there. I didn't even do them in the right order, but you get the point. If he was superlatively good, you'd have three of those. But these are fearing God, shunning evil, upright, and blameless. They're all there, four of them. On top of that, and by the way, I'll just say, the narrator tells us that, the Lord tells us that as he was having this conversation with the adversary. He says, have you looked at Job? You know, he's this, 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 and this. But on top of that, right from the get-go, Job is described as offering prayers and sacrifices for his kids. He knows what a mediator is and what a mediator does, which means he is familiar with the whole idea of intercession. Throughout the book, I mean, I realize it's not every verse, but you see three key points where he's pleading for somebody to be his advocate, his intercessor, his redeemer, his mediator, whatever. And he's expecting his friends to do it, or at least I think we might suppose that. And of course, they never do. They're just happily talking at him all the time or past him. When you get to chapter 42, and I realize I'm jumping the gun here, but as I said, this is in my mind the most important part of Job. When you get to chapter 42, in verses 7 and 8, the Lord rebukes Elihu and his two friends. And how does he do it? He says, you have not spoken correctly. And then there's a preposition. And that preposition for Hebraists who happen to be listening to this is el. Two. When that preposition follows the word to speak, to bear, 85% of the time it means two. And so I would submit that the Lord is castigating those friends because they have not served as friends should. They have not been the intercessors that Job needed, that Job longed for. And so God goes on, you haven't spoken correctly to me as my servant Job has. And the Lord says it twice. He repeats it. And then Job has to offer the sacrifice for them. So it circles back. I mean, we really have another fun inclusio here in some ways in terms of the character of Job, because he's been interceding for his kids at the beginning of chapter one. He's interceding on behalf of his friends who haven't done it for him when he was so desperately in need. There's lots and lots and lots of lessons in the book of Job. But one of them is really practical, and that's this: intercessory prayer. I think there's a profound lesson in intercessory prayer in this book, that it's taught by negative example. But on the other hand, it's what this suffering person needed more than anything else. Now, are there other lessons? Of course there are. But that is one that my students, at least some of them, really pick up on. And by the time they walk away from our 5-week study of Job, they say that that's something they want to practice better.
Hmm.
Listening and interceding.
That's amazing. Those are not the things, again, reworking assumptions of texts. Those are not the common things that we associate with Job. People go to Job to have debates about theodicy. What do we do with suffering in the world? Who is, like, if God is sovereign, why do people suffer? Like, we go to the text with that. We very rarely go to it with this, how can I be a better listener? How can I be a better intercessor for someone?
And those, you know, again, I'll just say it again, they are not the only lessons, but they, to me, are some of the most important practical takeaways, because theodicy has been discussed for centuries. And I'm not ruling out the importance of that discussion, but I don't think that has to be our main focus. In fact, I'm not even sure it's the primary focus of the Book of Job. And for this, I'm indebted to John Walton and others who basically say that Job is really about probing to the best of our ability the wisdom of God. Not theodicy issues. That's a very Western concept being imposed again on an Eastern text, but it's the wisdom of God. So basically the adversary is saying in chapter one to God, your design of the entire moral universe is flawed because people serve you only for the material good they get out of it. That's a challenge to, intrinsically a challenge to God's wisdom. And so, yes, Job will suffer horribly as this thing unfolds, but it really is not a trial of Job, it's a trial of God. The trial of God. And by the time we get to the end of it, it is God who is basically saying to Job, you know what? There's a lot more. I mean, those wonderful tours of the universe, and they are, starting with chapter 38, they're tours of the universe, is showing Job how much bigger everything is. How much more beautiful, how much more wild and chaotic. And God loves the wildness and God loves the chaos, and he's not beating it into place. That's wisdom. So the wisdom is one thing. Relationship too. You know, faithfulness is a lesson in this book, but Job longs for his relationship to be back.
I hope, like me, you have this burning desire to go back and read both of these books with Dr. Phillips' insights in mind. There are so many things we still have left to learn from this ancient Israelite body of wisdom literature. So now it is time to move on to the most infamous of love stories depicted in the Bible. For the Orthodox Christians who are listening to the show, I could not find out if the Song of Songs is in your lectionary, so you're going to have to write and let me know. Curiously, only 5 verses, which happen to be extremely tame, are included in the Protestant lectionary. So if your familiarity with the Bible comes from what is read in church, well, you're out of luck. Youth groups are infamous for tantalizing young people with portions of this book in order to discuss love and relationships. And in my experience, this is done in an absurdly poor way. So we have to take advantage of having a scholar like Dr. Phillips sitting with us right now. I want to end with this love story. But the more I talked with Dr. Phillips, the more I was seeing new aspects of a love story throughout all of this wisdom text. And I found that really interesting. But the Song of Songs is definitely more explicit of a love story. So it's not your typical love letter. It has some typical love letter-ish type emotional vulnerability and explicit-ish language in it. So it seems very intimate, and yet the types of images that are used are so foreign to us. So it seems intimate and familiar, and it seems completely foreign and unrelatable. So how do you pull those things together? Or how do you get your students to engage that?
Well, the first thing I'm going to do actually is connect with our Job thing, if I may, because I closed by saying that Job was longing for his relationship with God to be restored. And by the way, chapter 29 is saying that. What's fascinating to me is that through the centuries, the Song of Songs was commented on just about more than any other Old Testament book. We're talking about the Middle Ages, both Jewish and Christian commentators. And the reason was they read it allegorically as a love story between God and his people, and Maimonides, the soul longing for God and so forth. So you're right to make that connection. It really does fit. Having said that, of course, the allegorical interpretation has been kind of gone, well, it's gone by the boards since pretty much the 19th century. I'm going to circle back to little vestiges of that a little bit later on, after we talk about some of the things that you mentioned in terms of imagery and so forth and so on. But I want to emphasize right from the get-go, we are talking about a multi-layered love story here. Right, I think that's important to keep in mind. I don't get all bent out of shape about how many characters you have and whether Solomon's in here. One of the things that is fun to see is that the woman has the majority of the lines. And so, interestingly enough, if we were going to read it solely as allegorical of the love expressed from God to the church, or God to Israel and Christ to the church, that little detail throws a bit of a perturbation in that part of the allegory. But having said that, again, let me say what I think the most important stuff is, and then we can come back to imagery. It strikes me that when we look at this, we can read it as 19th and early 20th century folks did, maybe a disparate collection of love poetry, sort of like the Egyptian love poetry that you have, although that stuff is a lot more explicit than this. Or we can read it through another set of lenses, which recognizes specifically, well, maybe that's the wrong adverb, but recognizes the wider cultural context within which this book was shaped, and which also helps us understand why it's so necessary as part of the canon. And so here goes. And if I'm not making sense, pause me and make me circle back. An article I read by George Schwab, oh goodness, maybe 15 years ago, kind of pointed this out, and I've loved the idea. He said, you're dealing with our Israelite culture, which was always tempted by Baal worship, always tempted by public sexual prostitution, exploitation of sex for economic advantage. I mean, does that resonate into the 21st century? And he said, basically, this wonderful poem that does have a development through it, and there's some wonderful structural things too, we can talk about those if we have time, but this wonderful poem is a contrast to that public, brash exploitation of sex in supposed ritual worship context, but they were idolatrous and false. Instead, this poem emphasizes the beauty of privacy and intimacy, and the fact that this is between two people who love each other deeply, who suffer the same vulnerabilities, no question about it, as they're trying to wrestle through love and the, you know, the push and the pull of all that. But he said it was intended, and that's why it's so essential in the canon, because it was a subverting of the temptations from the wider cultural context. Now, are there other things that are part of the poem? Of course there are, part of the whole text. But that, to me, strikes me as a unifying theological theme that I think is important. Interestingly enough, dead center in the Song of Songs is the chapter about the lover entering his garden. And of course, that's redolent with Garden of Eden, King's Garden, privacy, intimacy, all those things. You know, there's just layers and layers and layers of interpretive stuff going on there that is really beautiful. And then, as a typical ancient Near Eastern thing goes, that's the center. You have working up to it, and then you have a continuation beyond in terms of the pattern of the text, finally ending with chapter 8 and that wonderful verse, set me like a seal on your heart, and then it extols the power of love. So, you know, that to me is probably what I try and get my students to think about. So they're dealing with more than simply, oh, is the Song of Songs simply adjuring us to wait until the right time when we get married. And then they try and find out when it is they're getting married in the text. Is it chapter 3 with the marriage? You know, that's not the point. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to be too snarky about that. But you
it's fantastic. Just flashbacks of growing up in youth groups.
Well, if youth groups even talked about it. I mean, that was the other issue, too. This was one of those texts that a lot of my students said, you know, we haven't really heard much about this text.
Right. It's interesting to me. There's a couple of tensions I have just as we're talking about it right now. When I think of ancient Near Eastern, like a normal, let's just say a normal Israelite household, this idea that people married for love is not an ancient concept. That's a modern concept. And we take our modern, like, romantic interest context and we read Song of Songs within that. You know, and I just, you know, this brings me to the imagery part, because it is filled,
filled with so much imagery that resonates from the land itself, from actually experiencing the land itself. And you have spent so much time in Israel, and you go back very regularly and teach. Like having such a familiar experience, like physical experience with the land, does that help you interpret this book or give you a different kind of lens to look at this love story using all of this land imagery?
I will, as I usually do, answer that through several lenses. Yes, to a degree, but I don't want to say that so that someone will feel like, well, I can't really read the Song of Songs unless I can unpack the image through that particular geographical lens. So I'm going to come back to the second part of my answer in a moment. But yes, I think it's fascinating, for example, that as they're rhapsodizing about each other's qualities, En-Gedi gets mentioned. Well, all right, you know, where's that? What is it? Well, among other things, and there's a lot we could say about En-Gedi itself, but it's a refreshing place. Oh, it's such a refreshing place next to a salt sea. So, you know, there's a juxtaposition there, and knowing a little bit more about all the beauty that's part of En-Gedi is there. Tirz and Jerusalem are referenced. They're nestled in the hills. They're more protected. You know, somebody who knows that. Lebanon is referenced, and that bespeaks sturdiness, power, tall trees, and all those kinds of things. Carmel is referenced in terms of a promontory sticking out into the Mediterranean. You know, those are things that, when one hears those words and has an image, something about that has another layer of interpretation that helps a lot. Having said that, I think someone can appreciate the Song of Songs, a lot of the imagery of the Song of Songs, simply by walking into a spice shop and letting those sensory nerve endings just be overwhelmed by this breeze of spices. And you know, there's something visceral about that. There's something that kind of goes beyond my ability even to put any of that into words. And so in the Song of Songs, once we realize that all of the senses are being appealed to, and this is a set of texts, wonderful words that are appealing to all of us to wake up our senses and to understand then the richness and the power of love, even in that particular perspective and through those lenses. So we have all kinds of things. I need to look at some thing that I wrote a while back. Oh yes, here it is. I knew that I had this. One of the things, and of course I haven't taught for a while, so I forgot this. But one of the things that I try and do with is in teaching this is to get students to remember four P's with regard to the Song of Songs and the love that's depicted. So the first one, of course, and I'm cheating, it's passionate. And, you know, this book does not hold back in terms of making sure that we know how passionate this is at whatever level and however it's conveyed. Those sensory experiences, I mean, the nerve endings are just vibrating like crazy. It's passionate. It's powerful. Right? It's definitely powerful. It's also possessive, right? We're dealing with a text that is articulating how this powerful emotion is one that is jealous too. And of course, that makes us think of God and his jealousy and his covenant relationship with his people. We're supposed to get that. And then our fourth P is perilous. This book does not mince words in terms of recognizing that there are perilous times in love as well. Very much so. You know, that I think it's chapter 5 where she's out in the nighttime and the watchmen beat her. And this is not a happy picture, the little vignette that shows up. So those things, when you put them all together, they kind of draw together a wide-ranging set of emotional responses to the book and understanding what's going on with that.
Hmm.
That may or may not help. I don't know.
I love it. I think it is Ellen Davis in her commentary of Song of Songs that talks about, and you mentioned the fact that there's multiple layers, and she talks about that too, just in terms of, can we move between all of these layers? You know, it does show this intimacy between two people. Maybe it is also the intimacy between God and his people, the jealousy he has for them, that type of vulnerability in that kind of relationship. Maybe it is also, and also, people in the land that God gave them, that kind of, are they caring and protecting and interacting with the land as well? You know, can we read all of these layers at the same time? And I think when we try to make it super simple and fit in one square box, we're doing a text like this a lot of disservice.
I couldn't agree with you more. Woe betide us if we just call it one category and then dismiss everything else. You know, if someone does not like the term allegory, fine, come up with a different term. But certainly we're talking about a rich, rich sense of a king and his people, of a garden, and all, as I said earlier, all the implications that are wound into that garden imagery. And one of them is two people going off into the hiddenness of a garden and having an intimate, private sexual encounter that is just plain beautiful.
As you were writing this book, was there one section of wisdom literature that you just had so much more fun writing? Like, did a new favorite come up for you?
No. I will simply say this. I think that the one I want to come back to, and I believe I basically coasted past some of the reasons why, would be Proverbs, because I kept feeling there's so much else to do. There's so much else to do. You know, I'd only begun to get a handle on words and what Proverbs has to say about words and leadership and friends and all those things. So I want to circle back to do that, because I don't think that's been done justice, or whatever you want to call it. Having said that, have I done that for Ecclesiastes and Job and Song of Songs? Probably not, but I feel like I want to come back to Proverbs for that same reason.
So what projects are you working on now that are getting in the way of you doing that with Proverbs? Or maybe not getting in the way, but maybe are just higher on the list?
Well, it is interesting. I actually, in 2018 for a sabbatical, had in mind to work on that very project I've described, and some other things got in the way. Two of them are those albatross deadlines that you feel right now. And by the way, I'm thankful for both of these projects, so don't take that the wrong way. But thanks to David Baker, who is one of the editors of the Apollos Commentary series, I am writing the volume on Obadiah, Jonah, and Micah. And so right now I am awash in the really challenging Hebrew of Micah. I'm loving it, but it's difficult Hebrew. I didn't realize how difficult the Hebrew of that particular book is. So I'm working on that.
You do not shy away from the difficult texts.
Well, so here's the confession. I didn't know what I was in for when I said yes. You know, you blithely say yes, and then you realize later that, whoa, this is really something. So I'm thankful now that I am retired and I have time to work on that. With Philip Camp from Lipscomb University, I've been co-editing a book on the theology of prayer in the Old Testament. We are at the stage now where it is with the publishing company itself. But that's been both wonderful to have these papers come in and work through them and learn through the authors who have written for them. But it's time consuming. Editing is, I have discovered, not exactly my gift. I'd rather be writing myself and let somebody else edit. Farther on down the pike is, and I think you are involved in this as well, the Women's Study Bible. I'm going to do several sections for the Women's Study Bible that will be a Brodmann Holman production. Somewhere way out in the, probably in that category of almost myth, whether we get there or not is going to be the question. I've wanted to do a book for a long time entitled Lost and Found, because I have several stories that are just remarkable illustrations of God's finding people, They're not just your garden variety pablum stories. So I want to do that somewhere along the line. That will be definitely a popular book if it ever comes out. Got to live that long.
Oh, thank you so much. I love being in your presence, even if it is virtually. It is. You're a constant reminder of the type of scholar I hope to become at some point.
Oh, Cindy, you are.
Oh,
you are.
Well, thank you
so
much.
Which is why, just, you know, this is why I was so enthusiastic about your new book that's coming out.
That's a great
plug. That'll be wonderful.
Plug.
That's a plug.
By the time this podcast comes out, the book will also be out and I will have had it in my hand for the first time, which I can't wait.
Oh, how exciting. The next time I see you, I'll make you autograph a copy.
Yes. Perfect. Well, thank you for creating time just to have this conversation. And I love the careful way you just take time with texts and allow them to speak in new and interesting ways to us. And in this new year that everyone hopes is going to be very different than 2020, I just hope maybe we can step into some of these wisdom texts and have them speak of God's wisdom to us, maybe in new and refreshing ways. So thank you so much.
It's been a pleasure. It really has. Thanks for inviting me. And, you know, God's wisdom, as I said, is an invitation, and there's always surprises there. So,
as always, it is so wonderful to sit and exchange ideas with you at this virtual table. Thank you for being a part of this podcast. If you want to help support this podcast, you can join my Patreon team with people like Lisa and Asuga Abaya. This team is responsible for getting us to our third season of Context Matters. So if you want to join, the link is in the show notes. The talented Peter Lordson of Sycamore Sound created all of the music you hear, and I look forward to our conversation next week with Dr. Sandy Richter, in which we discuss if Christians can be environmentalists. Until then, be safe, take care of each other, and stay curious about the world around you.